Hey, folks, you're listening to the free version of the Ring of Fire Radio podcast. You don't realize what you're missing. Or maybe you do, and you've just been lazy about it. But there's two-thirds more show that lies just a couple of pennies away. I know that's not an apt metaphor, but you get my point. For a couple of pennies a day, you can have access to the Ring of Fire Radio membership podcast. You get 3 hours of radio material without commercials. You get access to over 10 years of archived interviews and conversations. You'll love it. Head over to rofpodcast.com. Support the show. Hear even more of it. Thanks for your listening. See you next week. Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. On today's show, Farron Cousins from our Ring of Fire YouTube channel stops by to help me analyze Robert Mueller's testimony in front of two congressional committees, whether we are any closer to impeaching President Trump. Later in the show, we'll air my interviews from Netroots Nation 2019 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, where I spoke to elected officials, advocacy group members, and thought leaders in the progressive movement. If you're listening to the radio right now, you should know that there's a free one-hour podcast of Ring of Fire Radio on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever your podcasts are found. There's also a member show. You can support Ring of Fire by becoming a member and getting our three-hour radio show commercial-free. With access to 10 years of our archives, you can go to rofpodcast.com to sign up. Here to help me analyze this week's Mueller testimony, Farron Cousins, host of our Ring of Fire YouTube channel and editor of the Trial Lawyer magazine. So, Farron, the much-awaited testimony of Robert Mueller takes place this week. He had two, hearings. One was in front of the House Judiciary Committee. The other was in front of the House Intelligence Committee hearing. They were unique in some respects. They were unique in so far as the questions that were asked and the emphasis, and obviously unique in terms of the personnel, both in terms of Democrats and Republicans. There was a little overlap. Before we go through sort of some of the major points, what was your overall impression?
You know, my impression from the day before to watching it to the day after never really changed, and it was pretty much, why are we doing this? Mueller had told us back in, I guess it was May, the end of May when he did his press conference, that, listen, if you call me to testify, I'm not going to say anything that's not in that report. It's all available for you right there. You can read it right now if you want. There was massive election interference. You need to do something about it. Other than that, I'm done, so you shouldn't even call me to testify. And that's what he delivered yesterday. Absolutely, 206 different times where he said, read the report, look at the report. I'm not going to answer that, just read the report. And the weirdness of not wanting to read from his own report, but again, his staff had actually announced prior to the hearings that he was not going to read from his own report. The whole thing was very weird. There were some, bright spots during the hearing, but I think it basically played out how a lot of us just thought it was going to play out, which was we're going to stay glued to this and we're not really going to find out anything too new from it. And I don't feel like we did.
Well, I got to disagree with you a little bit, Farron. I mean, I think for the most part, everybody anticipated that we weren't going to get much by way of new information. And I think the reason to do it is because people don't pay attention. I don't know if even people paid that much attention to the actual testimony, to be honest with you, but certainly the huge number of people who have not read the report. And we got to remember, too, that Bill Barr had 2 weeks to essentially lie to the American public as to the question as to whether or not the report exonerated Donald Trump. And I think in addition to getting more nuance and detail on the dynamic surrounding Trump's culpability when it comes to obstruction, I actually thought there was one very important point that came out in the context of the questioning during the Intel committee. And that was with when he was being questioned, Mueller was, by New York Congressman Sean Maloney, not necessarily one of my favorite congresspeople. Nevertheless, his question was, why didn't you get testimony from Donald Trump? Why did you decide not to subpoena Donald Trump? Well, first off, Mueller said that he didn't want to subpoena Donald Trump because it would have been tied up in the courts for over a year or more, and there was pressure for him to finish the report. Now, of course, everyone would have been aware of the fact that Donald Trump was fighting a subpoena, and the pressure would not have been on him to finish the report. It would have become Donald Trump's responsibility. But the reason why he went forward at that point was fascinating, because he said it's a balancing test between what we anticipate we could get from hearing from the testimony of Donald Trump, which he had said earlier and in the report was paramount to understanding what went down and to discussing obstruction, versus weighed against how much existing evidence was already there to make the case that Donald Trump had obstructed. And that was, in my mind, the most explicit thing that Mueller said in terms of not just that they didn't bring charges against Donald Trump because of the OLC memo, which was one tract in which we sort of divine that was what Mueller was telling us. But the other tract is that he felt he did not, that the weighing against the waiting, the time on pursuing a subpoena against a sitting president versus the case that they had already made in his mind that the president had committed obstruction, that the latter actually won out. I think that's hugely important. It seems to me it's been completely overlooked, at least in the popular media. And look, this is, it's stunning, but Donald Trump has managed to normalize total lawbreaking in the context of his presidency. Never mind that we will not know the full story when it comes to collusion or conspiracy, for that matter, because of his obstruction. But the president clearly committed multiple offenses of obstruction of justice. And we know, frankly, that he's also committed multiple other offenses of corruption, all of which would have a place in the context of an impeachment inquiry. And so I think certainly in terms of the fireworks that people wanted, in terms of the drama that people wanted, you're right, Robert Mueller was dogged in his refusal to provide that. I wonder, frankly, you know, people have speculated that he's lost a step or two or five, frankly, after watching that performance. I also wondered to what extent that performance was somewhat premeditated insofar as he did not want to answer specific questions. I mean, it was interesting to me that he had his lawyer sworn in for the intelligence hearing, but not for the Judiciary Committee hearing. And when we come back, let's talk about the possibilities there. It seems that the Judiciary Committee was obviously looking, and to my mind, the Democrats were too singular in looking after obstruction. In the second hearing, the intelligence hearing, we were hearing more about what Russia actually did, according to our intelligence services, to interfere with the election. And I wonder if he felt more comfortable in that territory. But we will talk about some specific moments when we get back. I'm Sam Cedar, talking with the great Farron Cousins. This is Ring of Fire Radio.
Hey,
Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com. Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar here with Farron Cousins from Ring of Fire YouTube channel. Farron, in the first segment, we were talking our general over, broad perspectives on the Mueller hearings. You were a little bit less impressed than I was in terms of the information that came out. Were there specific moments, though, that you thought were important and that will function? I mean, because really the bottom line here, right, is will this in any way move the ball forward for more oversight and specifically get us closer to having impeachment hearings?
Well, I think in terms of getting us closer to having impeachment hearings, we've obviously seen a lot of calls for that, you know, just since the hearings took place. But we're not hearing it from the leadership. And I don't think we're going to hear it from the leadership. I mean, short of him coming out yesterday or Wednesday, and sitting down and saying, listen, I've got all kinds of stuff to tell you guys. Let me list all the crimes I haven't told you. Short of him doing that, I don't think anything was going to move the ball with Pelosi on the issue of impeachment. And obviously that didn't happen. You know, as I mentioned, you know, the reason I think this whole thing to me was a little bit of, you know, what's the point was because of the hype around it, you know, especially when we get those reports that came out on Tuesday from Politico that the Democrats were going all in. This was going to be their thing. They had the media response team. They had people sitting by on Twitter to tweet out, you know, all the horrible things that we were going to find out. They were going to use it. Actually, this was the plan. They were going to use these hearings to somehow try to shame the Senate Democrats into passing election security bills. This was their plan, as if those people can be shamed into doing anything. And so seeing the hype on that and obviously spending probably a little too much time on social media, people thinking that Mueller is going to save us, that was never going to happen. But as you pointed out, we did get some great stuff. Absolutely. And Mueller made it clear this is not an exoneration by any stretch of the imagination. Had it not been for the OLC, we probably would have gone ahead and gone forward with charges. And obviously one of the big ones, when he leaves office, assuming that's in 2021 in January, you can still prosecute him. So that door has not shut yet. It will likely be shut if he gets reelected. But those were some of the big moments, obviously. And of course, the massive discussion of election interference. And I think that is what Mueller desperately wanted to get across to the public more than anything else, that, yeah, there was interference. Yes, it benefited Donald Trump. But guess what? It's still happening today. And something has to be done about that.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think that we're probably going to move impeachment a little bit closer. I mean, Nancy Pelosi, maybe the idea is that she was going to, people claim that she has some type of like 10-dimensional chess going on here. She's clearly trying to run out the clock. I think it's a huge mistake. I think we enter into an impeachment inquiry knowing that the Republicans in the Senate will not vote on it. The only other thing I could speculate on is that Chuck Schumer is so weak that he is afraid that he cannot even carry the Democratic caucus in such a vote in the event that, in the event that Mitch McConnell would hold a vote. I suspect that is what is the biggest fear, frankly, is that the Democrats in the Senate would be afraid to vote for impeachment, and that would embarrass a lot of the people in the House. And right. by embarrass, I mean severely hurt their reelection chances if you can't even get the Democratic caucus in the Senate. But nevertheless, it's an important opportunity to put Republicans on the spot for their support for a criminal president. And we're going to have, you know, 14, 15 months between now and the election. And if the Democrats do not do something, and let's be clear here, right? They have passed 55, maybe 60 now, bills that is really very close to the wish list of, you know, the 75% of the wish list of Democrats, right? We're talking about things like rolling back Citizens United, things like $15 minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And no one has paid attention. No right. one has cared. Largely, I imagine, because these are, you know, largely symbolic votes because we don't have a president who will sign any of them. And also, I think people don't care because Donald Trump is the name of the game. And the bottom line is that if you're not going to perform oversight, you're not going to impeach, and you've run out of bills, dream bills to pass, what do you intend to do for the next year and a half? And why would you assume that Republicans not under pressure are not going to start digging into, you know, Benghazi part 11 or whatever it is? Like, this is the huge miscalculation here. And I just thought that the Democrats, particularly on the judiciary, I didn't think they did a very good job. I thought Nadler did good at the beginning. And I thought there was Zoe Loughran got a couple of good questions in. Ken Buck, a Republican, accidentally yeah. stepped in it, you know, got to Mueller to say that you could charge the president after the effect. David Cicilline from Rhode Island got Mueller to make it clear that, yes, you can be charged with obstruction, even if it's unsuccessful, even if there's no underlying crime, both those instances. Cedric Richmond got Mueller to agree that Trump administration had falsified records to protect Trump. Val Demings gets Mueller to agree that the Trump campaign impeded the investigation. Like I said, you had Maloney on the issue of a subpoena. Also in the Intelligence Committee, you had Mueller going so far as to not say the word impeach. He said, well, the constitutional processes are one of those things you just mentioned, right? I mean, it was absurd. It was like asking, like, I don't know, a cat to touch its paw on a some type of a button. But I'll give you the last word. We got 30 seconds left, Farron. What do you think we can expect going forward? Are we just going to forget about this or what?
See, I don't think it gets forgotten. And I think the people in the House who are pushing for impeachment, and we're hearing it from more and more presidential candidates, you know, Elizabeth Warren's out there saying it. But an impeachment inquiry, this obstruction of justice has to be the, you know, basically the foundation of it. But you've got to also expand it to emoluments violations, the bank records, the tax returns, you know, up in New York, especially. All of that needs to be part of it. And we could get it done or at least get enough info in 12 months to really show the public who this guy is. And the inquiry has to happen. I don't care if Pelosi thinks it's a bad idea. It's probably one of the best ways to ensure a victory in 2020.
Appreciate the help, Farron.
Thank you.
Farron Cousins is the editor of the Trial Lawyer magazine and our online contributor for a Ring of Fire YouTube channel. You can find more at youtube.com/TheRingOfFire. When we come back, we'll air an interview I recorded at the recent Netroots Nation 2019 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. I sat down with two secretaries of state to discuss the rights attacks on our voting rights. I'm Sam Cedar. You're listening to Ring of Fire Radio. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he's been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours pouring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. I recently attended Netroots Nation 2019 in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is, of course, an annual event held each year for politicians, advocacy groups, and media groups to convene and discuss how to move the progressive movement forward. I'm going to play an interview that I recorded with Connecticut Secretary of State Denise Merrill, along with California's Secretary of State Alex Padilla, where we discussed the right's attack on the right to vote and the issue of gerrymandering. Let's listen to that interview now. So continuing my coverage at Netroots Nation 2019, sitting with me now is Denise Merrill. She is the Connecticut Secretary of State, and Alex Padilla. He is also the Secretary of State of California. Yes. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you for having us on.
So, Denise, you and I spoke last year at Netroots Nation, and it was in the wake, I guess, of Kris Kobach's attempt to disenfranchise gosh knows how many voters around the country that he could. That seems to have all fallen apart for him, hasn't it?
Entirely. I would say it is certainly, we put a dent in it. We certainly disempowered the presidential commission, which had been formed with him at the head, where they were trying to centralize all the voter lists in the country. We have certainly discredited the cross-check system that they had devised for taking people off the voter rolls. And since that time, he's become even more notorious for his efforts to disenfranchise citizens. And so this has been an ongoing effort, and he's still in the middle of it. But we did have some victories along the way, I would say.
Alex, as the Secretary of State, like, to what extent, how much of your job do you perceive as protecting the right to vote versus sort of just administering it, I guess?
Look, I think the right to vote is fundamental in our work as Secretaries of State. If you look at state statutes across the country, most Secretaries of State are referred to as Chief Elections Officer. And the specific duties and responsibilities may sound very ministerial, right? But if you believe in the fundamental principles of our democracy and the philosophy that our democracy works best when as many people who are eligible can participate, and you believe in the Federal Voting Rights Act, which states that there should be no unnecessary obstacles or barriers to that civic participation, that has to be at the core of our work as Secretaries of State, not just ministerial, being passive, you know, how many ballots were cast, and here's the results. But what can we do proactively to engage and encourage all eligible citizens to register to vote and get every person who's eligible and registered to actually cast a ballot? Believe in it so much so that we actually added that specific language to California state law. So once my term is done, future secretaries will have a statutory obligation to be proactive in increasing participation rates, not just making sure that the ballots are counted correctly.
So to what extent are those type of provisions nationally? For instance, in Connecticut, Denise, do you have that same statutory obligation to be proactive?
Yes.
Okay, so the threshold here is elevated from where it is on a federal level. And when we look at the states across the country, Alex, how many of the states have that higher threshold in terms of protecting the franchise?
Protecting the franchise, I think that just comes to the philosophy of the Secretary of State that's in place, right? And it's only a handful of states that will have that proactive statutory, you know, duty or responsibility. I think the bigger picture here, and we've been living this for a few years now, since the current occupant of the Oval Office, elections should not be a partisan debate. Right? Getting every eligible citizen to register and to be able to cast their ballot free of intimidation or unnecessary obstacles should not be a partisan discussion. But unfortunately, it is all too clear. The red states, who the Republican secretaries, is where you see it being more difficult to register to vote, a.k.a. Kobach, show me your papers, more difficult to stay on the voter rolls. If you look at, you know, what they're doing in Indiana and Ohio, where they begin to remove you from the voter rolls if you missed a couple of elections. But if you look at the bluer states and where the Democratic secretaries are serving, that's where we're actually enabling participation through online voter registration, automatic voter registration, same-day registration, pre-registration of 16 and 17-year-olds. Elections administration and voting should not, you know, that's motherhood and apple pie. That's at the core of our democracy. But the Republican Party sure has tried to politicize it and weaponize it.
This has been a long time project, right, to disenfranchise. It depends on who the party was, because certainly, obviously, we had Jim Crow laws, we had literacy tests, we had stuff all the way up to the Voting Rights Act, which is why we need the Voting Rights Act to avoid people. And that was not necessarily the Republican or Democratic Party. It was more sort of associated with a group of states, counties that were ultimately placed under a preclearance with the DOJ. To be clear, that includes New York City, had a couple of counties as well.
Right.
Now, however, it's quite clear that there's party delineations. Let me ask you this, Denise. If I was someone who felt like, okay, I'm now watching the conservative movement launch a systematic attack on the right of specific, you know, to a large extent, people of color's right to vote.
Right.
Broadly speaking, I think that's a fair assessment, whether it's on the Supreme Court in rolling back the Voting Rights Act and destroying the preclearance provisions, whether it's, you know, the relentless pursuit by Kris Kobach and using names that may be shared across whatever it is. If I wanted to step in with $100 million, let's say, and I wanted to run Secretary of States in states that were even red states, is there enough autonomy there that they could actually reverse things if I was to get a Democrat elected Secretary of State? Or would the state houses just step in and legislate away the ability of a Secretary of State to proactively help people vote?
Well, first of all, you have to remember all of this is relatively recent, at least since the Voting Rights Act. I think those of us who have come of age during this period thought it was a settled question after 1965. So it really ramped up again when Obama got elected. I don't think that's an accident either. But in 2010, we lost something like 12 secretaries of state throughout the country, Democrats, and they all flipped Republican. I think that was pretty much the same as the governors. That's when we lost the legislatures. We really weren't paying attention, I think, as a party at least, speaking as a Democrat, to what was going on. But definitely you've seen secretaries assume power in states that we honestly, I'm not sure I realized that we had that kind of power. For example, in Ohio, when John Husted came in about 2008, 2010, maybe exactly this time period, he started, you know, making up new rules, really, about when you could take people off the voting rolls. As you suggest, it's a federal law that you're supposed to give people notice. You know, they don't vote in two elections, and then you have to give them notice, and then you can put them on a separate list. But he kind of rewrote that rule, and it did go to court, and he won. Wow. And they were allowed to do it. But, you know, they're testing those limits. Secretaries of State, I mean, they're very different in each state, admittedly, but a lot of them have a lot of control over what goes on administratively, much more than I think people realized at the time.
All right, we got to take a break. When we do, I want to come back and talk about what I know both of you have been here at Netroots Nation talking about, and that is the census, which is sort of, I guess, the next chapter, the next sub-chapter, maybe, on the assault of the vote in this country. And this is a doozy. We're also having this conversation on a day when the President of the United States has said, I'm just going to add that question by executive order. When we come back, let's talk about his ability to do that. We will walk through this story and why the implications of this are so dramatic for not just for voting, but for the way that we organize our politics and our governmental services in this country. We got to take a quick break. I'm Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. We'll be right back from Netroots Nation. Folks, the Ring of Fire is sponsored by JustCoffee.coop. That's JustCoffee.coop. If you like fair trade, delicious coffee, tea, or chocolate, head over to JustCoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY and get 10% off. There's free shipping. You have no reason not to get this great coffee. It's a great outfit in Madison, Wisconsin, which supported the protests there. JustCoffee.coop.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Sam Cedar. Let's return to my recent interview with California Secretary of State Alex Padilla and Connecticut Secretary of State Denise Merrill, recorded at the recent Netroots Nation Convention in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We are back, Sam Cedar, Ring of Fire Radio. I continue with my coverage at Netroots Nation. This is happening July 11th. And with me, Denise Merrill. She is the Democratic Secretary of State from the state of Connecticut. And also Alex Padilla. He is the Secretary of State of the state of California, also a Democrat. Both of you are here today, at least in part, to talk about the census, because obviously Secretary of State, both of you have told me in the last segment that you have laws in your state that actually raise the threshold for the sanctity of the vote in many ways, that you have proactive powers to increase voter turnout, to increase the franchise, to get as many people to vote as possible, which is theoretically what you'd want in a democracy. That theory is broken down quite a bit. We've had really a solid almost 10 years of assault on voting rights, whether it's the diminishment of the Voting Rights Act or all of the gerrymandering that took place in the wake of 2010. So what, from your perspective, Alex, when you hear about putting this question, California, obviously this is a big deal, this question of, are you an immigrant? Or what is your citizenship status on the census? How do you What are the implications of that question on the census, just in the context of California?
Sure, and we'll do a little bit of a dive here on what the potential question means. But it's part of the greater playbook for Trump and Bannon and Kobach and their cronies to amass and maintain political power. That's at the core of all this. Trump's decision to question the citizenship of every person in America, because that's, in essence, what he wants to do, we know from prior experience has the effect of discouraging or outright intimidating people from participating in the census, which undermines the very purpose of the census and the mandate for the Department of Commerce and the Census Bureau. It is written into our United States Constitution that every 10 years there shall be, quote, a national population count, not a national citizen count, a national population count. And the population count, the census data is used for what I refer to as the three R's: determine resources, reapportionment, and redistricting. A lot of federal funds that are appropriated every year, billions upon billions for housing, for health care, for infrastructure, for education, and more on a per capita basis to states. So in a state like California, the most populous and most diverse state in the nation, if we were to have a significant undercount, we literally lose out on billions and billions of dollars. But beyond that, speaking to the political power of this, it is the census data that determines each state's representation in Congress. So when there's an undercount, you literally don't get your fair share of representation or your voice in Congress that you would normally deserve. And then by extension, it is very hard to draw fair districts for federal, state, and local offices if you have inaccurate population data, which we rely on the census. So the stakes are huge. Political power is at stake. Funding for core services in communities across the country are at stake, and that's why I think the Trump administration has weaponized this too.
It affects the Electoral College as well. You get less electoral votes in the context of a presidential election. So, Denise, let me ask you this. I mean, now, I think this audience is fairly well-versed in the fact that there just so happens, as this census case was going to the Supreme Court, a man who was known as the godfather of the gerrymander for the Republicans, a guy named Hofstadter, I think it was, he died. His daughter found a couple of hard drives. On those hard drives was literally a study of what happens if you put this question on the ballot and how would it impact a district in Texas. And I think the results are, I'm paraphrasing, but I may be quoting, it will enhance the power of non-white Hispanics, of white non-Hispanics,
right,
and of Republicans.
And Republicans, that's right.
All right, but what do you say to, like, someone who says, well, okay, I'm not aware of that study done by a Republican who was then subsequently pushed this question on there, and there's a lot more to that story, but the Supreme Court has at least addressed it in part. But what do you say, like, well, wait a second, why should that scare anybody? I'm asking you whether you're a citizen. If you're a citizen, yeah, I'm a citizen. I'm not worried about it. Why should that scare anybody?
Well, that's right. And that is what's being said. And that's what's so insidious about it, in a way. Here is someone who is deliberately making the census a partisan document. That has never been done before and shouldn't be done. It's in the Constitution that it's supposed to count all people. So the introduction of this notion that somehow we're going to count all the citizens and question your citizenship, especially when you put it in the context of all the other things going on, the intimidation, the threats of roundup of people who are non-citizens by ICE, the detention of these children at the borders. I mean, there is so much fear in the community of people, sometimes who have been here all their lives. That I think that you have to look at the whole picture and you can see why people are scared. And you can see why people say, well, why shouldn't we know who are citizens? It's just like the argument about photo ID. Why shouldn't people be required to have a photo ID? Well, because when you delve into it, it's a very interesting argument because it sounds reasonable until you look at it for real and you realize what that question really means. And I think when you talk to people about that, then they kind of get it. I mean, as I said to the audience on the panel, you think about it, there's a lot of distrust of government among everyone now.
Right.
I'm really concerned that when you get that card in the mail in March or whatever it is, there's a lot of people that might say, oh, I'm not sure this is really that. I mean, talk about fear and distrust. How about all the, you know, disinformation campaigns going on and things that might make you not trust that postcard, even whoever you are?
Right.
So we're fighting a lot of fear and distrust out there among everyone, and that's part of the problem.
I mean, what do you say to that, Alex? I mean, what do you say to someone who says, well, okay, I know the census says you got to count every people, but that doesn't mean that we have to have services for every people. I mean, what if someone says that to you? Like, well, look, I mean, I don't care that there's, non-citizens, whether they're undocumented or they're overstayed their visa or they're just on a green card or whatnot. Why should I pay for them?
Well, I think there's a couple of things from a governance standpoint. And then as a citizen, I'll give you that perspective as well. From a governance standpoint, look, that is a debate. Level of fundings for education versus first responders versus anything else. There's a legislative process at your city council, maybe in the legislature, or maybe even in Congress to determine the levels of funding for different policy priority areas. But one thing is absolutely clear. It is written into the United States Constitution that every 10 years there should be a national population count that, again, that the data that comes from that is used for policymaking, for budgeting and appropriation, for redistricting, et cetera. So this is a matter of fulfilling a constitutional mandate. And now, the history of the census, not always pretty. Once upon a time, Black Americans only accounted for 3/5
right.
of a person. And some people may say, well, that was long ago history, but that is part of our nation's history.
Also used to help intern
in World
Japanese.
War II, census
That's
data
right.
was used yep. to help intern people of Japanese descent, right? Not as long ago history, that is part of our history. Since then, federal laws have been put in place to prohibit the use or sharing of any personal information with other departments, other agencies, for any other purposes. But if you ask people, do they trust this president to respect and honor federal law and protections, I think you know what the answer is going to be.
Yep, and frankly, who could blame them? Alex Padilla, Denise Merrill, Secretaries of State, both from Connecticut and California, respectively. Thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Nice being here.
When we come back, more interviews from our recent trip to Philadelphia for Netroots Nation 2019. If you missed any part of this show, go to ROFpodcast.com, become a member. You'll get the full show commercial free. And you can listen to any of our archive shows from over a decade with all your favorite guests. I'm Sam Cedar. We'll be right back after the break. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.